Living on Earth needs your support to be heard each week. Kindly give what you can today by using the donate link to the left of this page. Thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwin.
And I'm Jeff Young. President Obama returned from his trip to Moscow with an agreement in principle for the U.S. and Russia to reduce nuclear arsenals by up to a third. It's one of many steps experts say must be taken to deter proliferation and keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists. The Mideast and Asia are rife with nuclear tension. Israel is presumed to have the bomb. And just last month, a senior al-Qaeda leader said his group aims to seize Pakistan's nuclear arsenal and use it against Americans. The threat was underscored by the recent suicide bombing of a bus carrying workers from a Pakistani nuclear lab.
Defense expert Graham Allison says the threat of nuclear terrorism and the resulting human and ecological devastation is greater now than ever. Graham Allison was Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Clinton administration and is now a professor at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Professor Allison, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've recently been serving the federal government with the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. Tell me about that work.
Well, Congress established a year ago a commission on preventing weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, and terrorism. So it's a mouthful.
Yes.
As a successor to the 9/11 commission, and we issued our report in December and carefully, after a lot of debate and deliberation, entitled it World at Risk. And the conclusion was that on the current trajectory, terrorists will successfully conduct a nuclear or biological terrorist attack somewhere in the world in the next 5 years. That's more likely than not. We're losing ground. We're less safe today than we were 5 years ago, and we'll be less safe 5 years from now. So it's a call for bending the trend lines that are otherwise leading us to a pretty catastrophic consequence.
Let's talk about the fundamentals of the threat here. What are the scenarios that you look at in terms of a nuclear terrorist attack?
In the book that I published in 2004 called Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe, in the introduction, I tell the story of Dragonfire.
Dragonfire?
Dragonfire. Dragonfire is the name of a source, an intelligence source, who reported just 1 month to the day after 9/11 that al-Qaeda had got a small nuclear bomb out of the former Soviet arsenal, had brought that bomb to New York City, and might be about to explode it.
Sounds like a movie.
It does sound like a movie. When George Tenet, who was then the director of CIA, went to give the president's daily intelligence briefing, he explained this to President Bush, and there was a moment to catch breath and then an interrogatory that went something like the following. Did the former Soviet arsenal include weapons of the description of the bomb that Dragonfire had provided? Answer, yes. Were all those weapons adequately accounted for? Answer, no. Could al-Qaeda have got one of those weapons and brought it to New York City and be about to explode it and we not otherwise know anything about it? Answer, yes. So the conclusion from this was there was no basis for dismissing Dragonfire's report. And on this basis, the president ordered nuclear experts to go to New York to look for signs of radiation. And for months after this event, Cheney was missing from Washington because the thought was maybe there'd be a bomb in Washington, and if it exploded in Washington, would destroy the government we have. We would still like to have political authority. So there's an alternative site that was created during the Cold War where the Cheney and actually a couple of thousand people from agencies of the U.S. government went and stayed for some months. Now, it turned out to be a false alarm, but the important takeaway from this is that there was no basis in science, no basis in technology, no basis in logic for dismissing an account that al-Qaeda, the guys that had just killed 3,000 people, now had a weapon that would kill 300,000 people.
So how easy is it, if someone wanted to get a hold of nuclear weapons?
Well, fortunately, you can't just order up a nuclear weapon from the internet. Thank goodness there's not any for sale on eBay. The happy good news is that it's much more complicated than first blush. Without fissile material, you can't make a mushroom cloud. Fissile material comes in only two brands, highly enriched uranium and plutonium. Neither of these occur in nature. So you can't go dig them up or just go find them. Making highly enriched uranium or plutonium is a huge industrial undertaking. took the U.S. the Manhattan Project. I mean, that was the big breakthrough to make the material. So the good news is no fissile material, no nuclear terrorism. The bad news is that there's a lot of nuclear weapons and a lot of material, a lot of it not adequately secured.
Or accounted for.
Or even accounted for, because in the former Soviet Union, you had this vast undertaking during the Cold War in which it's not even clear they knew how much material or how many weapons they ultimately created.
And as I understand, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the stands had a lot of these weapons, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan.
Ukraine, Kazakhstan, absolutely. No, I was Assistant Secretary of Defense in 1993, so the beginning of the Clinton administration. And one of the first things I did was, with a person from the State Department, we traveled around the places where these nuclear weapons were or had been. Now, at the time that the Soviet Union disappeared, so that's December 1991, there were about 14,000 nuclear weapons, best estimate, left outside of Russia. There were 2,620 weapons in Ukraine, about 1,000 weapons in Belarus. And we believe all those nuclear weapons were taken out of those 14 states and back to Russia. That's what we believe, in the sense that we haven't found one anywhere else. But if you said, is it possible that some went missing? The answer is it certainly is. And is it possible that some material from which terrorists could make a bomb went missing? Certainly is. There was a very good report that George Tenet says something about in his memoir of people negotiating to buy four bombs. These were al-Qaeda folks in Saudi Arabia. Again, people tried to trace down this story and never got to the bottom of it. There have been rumors that Iran may have bought one or two or several such weapons. So we haven't found one of these weapons so far, and I give thanks for that every day, but we don't know what we don't know.
So if someone got a hold of these materials, how easy, how difficult would it be to, say, bring them into the United States?
Well, that's a... unfortunately, an easy question to answer, because one needs to ask how many illegal things of approximately that size come into the U.S. every day. Now, every city knows that drugs come to the U.S. How do they get here? They come in cargo containers. They come in ships. They come across the Mexican border. They come across the Canadian border. They may come in a sailboat. I mean, we're here in Boston. How hard is it to get into a sailboat and sail to Canada and to sail back? And if you put your sailboat in Marblehead, do you cross some line in the ocean that says you're entering American water? No, of course you don't. And when you arrive at the dock in Marblehead, does somebody inspect your boat? No, of course they don't. So I would say, unfortunately, the ability of terrorists to bring a weapon to target, we just would say follow the drugs.
And one needs about what? 10 pounds of plutonium?
Well, 10 pounds of plutonium would be sufficient for making a bomb. The easier form of a bomb would be highly enriched uranium. And there, ideally, you would have about 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, but it's very dense stuff. So this would be smaller than a football.
Of course, when one looks into the darkness, it's easy to be frightened by all kinds of things. One of the scenario that came up as we were preparing for this discussion with you is what if one of these things went off not in a great American city, but in a relatively small one, followed by a note that says, there's another one waiting to go off if you don't do X, Y, or Z. I mean, is this a Grey B movie or what?
It is, but unfortunately the 9/11 attack looked like, for many people, an unbelievable movie that they simply couldn't imagine. We have to remember that the U.S., who's the only country actually ever used nuclear weapons against another state, dropped first a bomb on Hiroshima.
A small city.
And secondly, a few days later, on Nagasaki.
Another small city.
Another small city. And at that point, the Emperor of Japan said, Uncle, I give up. So if one bomb exploded just in one city, a small city, and if there were threats that there were weapons in other cities, well, the question now the president would be wrestling with and his advisors is, how likely is it that these guys have another bomb? And since a president couldn't be seen to be yielding to such blackmail, I suspect that you would play it out for the second round. But now, I mean, if you're playing your movie, so now two bombs of a second city's gone off, and there's a threat of a third city. So this is a nightmare.
This is chaos. This is a breakdown of our society.
And I think you could easily imagine people in cities self-evacuating. I mean, go back to the Dragonfire story that I mentioned to begin with. President Bush decided not to inform the city of New York, including Mayor Giuliani. So you remember here, this is a month after 9/11. Giuliani's been the man on the scene, the mayor. So they didn't inform him about the Dragonfire report that there was a nuclear bomb in the city. And why didn't they inform him? Because if you inform the mayor, he's going to inform the police commissioner. And the police commissioner is going to inform the assistant police commissioner. And pretty soon there's going to be a story out that President Bush believes there might be a nuclear bomb in New York City. A month after 9/11, you would have had people fleeing the city massively. They thought this would be a panic.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about here is a state using a nuclear bomb. Now, some folks say that, well, actually, nuclear bombs are pretty useless for states. Why do they say that?
In general, if a state were to use a nuclear weapon, particularly to deliver a weapon by a missile against another state, let's take North Korea. The attack would leave an unambiguous return address. And North Korea would know that the U.S. would know that this missile came from this particular place in North Korea, and the U.S. would respond to this with an overwhelming retaliatory response. So the reason why a state would not rationally attack a state that has nuclear weapons, like the U.S., with a nuclear weapon is that it would be suicidal. Terrorists who deliver a bomb are not going to deliver it by a missile. They're going to have delivered it by bringing it in the hull of a ship that comes into a harbor. So when the bomb explodes, we're not going to be able to identify this unambiguous return address. This is a huge advantage for a terrorist relative to a state. Secondly, some terrorists appeared to want to be suicidal. So when you've got somebody who is prepared to die in the course of conducting their attack, the threat to kill them doesn't have quite the same deterrent effect.
So if it's difficult, if almost impossible for a state to use a nuclear weapon, why all the brouhaha about Iran getting nuclear weapons?
Well, that's a very good question. If Iran succeeds with its current project, which will give it a nuclear bomb sometime in the 2012-13 period, perhaps, is that likely to be the end of the story in the region? Or will not Saudi Arabia, which thinks of itself as the leader of the Sunni Muslim community, demand to be equivalent? Will not Egypt, which thinks of itself as the political leader of the area? So most people, and including myself, believe that if Iran becomes a nuclear weapon state, one will see a knock-on effect, in effect a cascade of proliferation in the region. Well, the region is already extremely volatile. And in a situation in which other states are pursuing or about to get nuclear weapons, in which Israel probably would attack somebody along the way, one would expect that this would be a very destabilizing scenario. In the same way that if North Korea becomes a recognized nuclear weapon state, most people, including myself, believe that this will end up having a corrosive effect on Japan and maybe South Korea. And as a consequence, if we look at these two urgent cases today, both of which are losing hands, I mean, to tell the truth. I mean, the North Korean hand, North Korea has 10 bombs worth of plutonium and has conducted a second test. And we can say you simply can't do that, but they did it. So in both of these cases, if they should become nuclear weapon states, I think the whole nonproliferation regime is likely to unravel. And then we will be in a world of multiple nuclear weapon states in which they're leapfrogging each other, in which I would think it's likely that nuclear weapons will be used in one or more cases, and that some weapons will come loose, and so there'll be even more opportunities for people like terrorists to destroy our cities.
So how did your group come to the conclusion that there's a better than 50-50 chance that we'll see the detonation of a nuclear device someplace in the world by a non-state organization?
Well, nuclear or biological. So we
nuclear or biological. Okay.
I mean, we worked our way through this, and we certainly took testimony from all the experts across the U.S. government, from experts in other governments, including the British government, the Pakistani government. unfortunately, the physical facts are such as they are, that there's people with motive, there's potential means, and there are huge opportunities. And you put all that together, and it seems more remarkable that something terrible hasn't happened than that something terrible would happen.
So as a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, as a person with all the security clearances in this area, you're sitting here telling me, really, it would have been more likely that this would have already happened than not.
In my view, just because we can now vividly imagine al-Qaeda getting a nuclear bomb, bringing it to an American city, destroying the heart of that city, and changing our world. You look at the means available, you look at the opportunity, and I give thanks that it hasn't happened. But this is a preventable catastrophe.
How?
There's a feasible, affordable agenda of actions that if we took would reduce the likelihood of this to nearly zero. And there are long, complex lists, but the core of it is that on the supply side, there's this happy syllogism from physics. No fissile material, no mushroom cloud, no nuclear terrorism. So fortunately, they can't make the fissile material. What we have to do is make sure that all nuclear weapons everywhere and all nuclear material is locked up as good as gold. How much gold has U.S. lost from Fort Knox? Zero. So do human beings know how to lock up things that we really won't care about? Yes, of course we do. Well, is there some reason why nuclear weapons and materials should be less secure than gold? I mean, what is gold? So President Obama, in his speech in April at Prague, stated a very ambitious agenda with respect to this nuclear terrorism topic, in which one of them was that all nuclear weapons and all material everywhere in the world was going to be secured to a gold standard in 4 years. So my takeaway from this, and the most important bottom line, is not fatalism about this, or not even pessimism, but to say, my goodness, we can get our mind around what a world would be like if this, God forbid, happened. If there are things we can do that reduce the likelihood of that to nearly zero, what in the world are we doing?
What are we waiting for?
What are we waiting for, exactly?
Graham Allison is author of Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. He's a political scientist at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Professor Allison, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Bascom, Eileen Bolinsky, Bruce Gellerman, Ingrid Lobet, Helen Palmer, Jessica Elise Smith, Ike Shriskanjaraja, and Beecher Taj, with help from Sarah Calkins, Marilyn Gavoni, and Sammy Souza.
Our interns are Annie Glosser and Lisa Song. This show was engineered by Dana Chisholm. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Learish-Dean composed our themes. You can find us anytime at loe.org. I'm Steve Kerwood.
And I'm Jeff Young. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science, and Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners. The Ford Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of climate change and marine issues. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And Pax World Mutual Funds, socially and environmentally sustainable investing. Pax World for tomorrow. On the web at paxworld.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.